Jude, verse 16. These are murmurers, complainers, walking after their own lusts, and their mouth speaks great swelling words, having men's person in admiration because of advantage. In this verse, our apostle excellently applies the aforementioned prophecy of the last judgment to these seducers, shown by a number apt and pregnant proofs that these seducers were guilty of that ungodliness for which the wicked of the last day were to be judged. And they discovered their ungodliness these four ways: by being murmurers and complainers, by following their lusts, by boasting, speaking great swelling words, by their admiration of men's persons. First, they discover their ungodliness by showing themselves murmurers and complainers. I shall in this show who are meant by murmurers and complainers, and then why Jude expresses himself against them, or what is the greatness or heinousness of this their sin in being murmurers and complainers. The word murmurers imports an expressing of discontentedness against another in our words, and that not aloud with a high voice, but with a voice somewhat low, muttering, grumbling. The words come, say some, from the word to grunt is fat swine, and so import secretly to speak against others, saith Gerard, with hatred and impatience. Thus they who receive but a penny for their work, thinking themselves wronged, murmured against the good men of the house, Matthew 20, verse 11. And the scribes and Pharisees murmured against Christ and his disciples for eating with publicans and sinners. And the Jews murmured at him because he said, I am the bread of life, John 6, 41. So 1 Corinthians 10:10, neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. Though sometimes, as Beza notes, the word is taken for any close secret whispering of a manner without offense and indignation, is John 7, 12 and 32, yet most frequently and properly it is used in the former signification. This murmuring may be either against men or against God himself. The word here used by Jude, by its own force, signifies not one more than another. Against man, have men frequently murmured, is the Israelites against Moses and Aaron. Nor is anything more usual than for people to murmur, especially against their governors, out of envy, impatience, or discontent. A sin, questionless, which these seducers were deeply guilty of, who despised dominions and spake evil of dignities. And yet because the apostle had accused them for that sin before in verse 8, and also threatened destruction against them for it in verse 11, because also the next word, complainers, in which the apostle shows a cause of their murmuring, notes a complaining of that lot, portion, and condition set out by God for us. I rather conceive that this murmuring here, with which Jude charges these seducers, was their muttering of impatient, discontented expressions against God himself, with whom they were angry and displeased. A distemper which allowed is an evident sign of an ungracious, ungodly heart. The thing which also Jude here intends to prove, and contrary to that quiet and silent submissiveness of the godly, who with David are dumb and open not their mouth, because the Lord has done it. Psalm 39:9. Who will be pleased with God and with whatever he does when he is most angry with them? Who will justify him when he seems to condemn them? A sin likewise in this murmuring against God, of which the ungodly Israelites are frequently accused, is Deuteronomy 1:27. Exodus 15:24, and for which they were severely punished. Concerning those who by murmuring showed themselves displeased with God, the apostle tells us that God was not well pleased with them, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Their displeasure was wicked and sinful, but yet weak and impotent. God's was holy and righteous, and withal potent and irresistible. Man has no ability with his anger. He may hate God, but he cannot hurt him. Nay, instead of this, he only hurts himself. Every arrow which he shoots up to God falls down upon his own head. The other expression in which Jude sets forth their sin is translated complainers, which does not, as indeed I think no one word can fully express, the force of the word used by the apostle, which signifies complainers, blamers, or accusers of that part, portion, or allotment, which was set out for them in the world. The word being made up of two words, the one which signifies blaming or complaining, the other allot, portion, or division. The apostle then, by this word, complainers of their lot and portion, explains the former, murmurers, by showing that it was at which these people murmured, namely, that their condition in the world was not so rich, great, and honorable as was that some of others. They murmured as if God had unequally distributed their estate and portion because they had not as much as others. They thought they had not enough, nay, nothing. Happily, they were displeased that they were not the governors of the world, that any were above them, and indeed was a true reason why they spake evil of dignities and opposed magistrates, not because they hated ruling, but because they themselves were not the rulers. And this further clearing of their sin by the apostle further proves them ungodly. The apostle's scope, for in complaining of their lot and portion, what did they but accuse God either of want of righteousness or wisdom in his distributions and dispensations, as if either he had defrauded them of their due or not understood fitly to proportion their estates. And what can be more contrary to godliness, which, as the apostle speaks, is joined with contentment or self-sufficiency, 1 Timothy 6:6, than discontentedly never to be suffice with what God has laid out for us? But more unlike that holy disposition of saints in which they say with David, "The Lord is the portion of mine inheritance. The lines are fallen unto me in pleasant places. Yea, I have a goodly heritage." Psalm 16, 5 and 6. Discontentedness with our times and estates is that which the Holy Ghost deservedly charges with sinful folly. Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this, Ecclesiastes 7:10. That is, do not, by considering of the goodness of former times, complain discontentedly of God's providence in ordering thee to live in those which he has allotted for thee. Number two, why Jude expresses himself against their murmuring and complaining, or what is the heinousness considerable in this, their sin? I answer, our apostle, by charging them with this, as I said, intends to prove them ungodly men and such bold sinners as uttered hard speeches against God. Now how much ungodliness lays open itself by the sin of murmuring, discontentedness against God's administrations, appears by considering what those sins are in which this sin is made up and consists, and wherewith it is ever accompanied. In this is contained that great sin of unbelief and distrustfulness. He who complains of his portion does not believe that God is his portion and will supply him accordingly. He who believes that God is his portion needs not complain of his portion. No, he that can say with David, "The Lord is the portion of mine inheritance," will undoubtedly add, "The lines are fallen unto me in pleasant places. I have a goodly heritage." Psalm 16, 5 and 6. That God who is self-sufficient is all-sufficient, sufficient for the soul, fills every corner of it. The bee in the hive puts not forth its sting, nor does the soul, when centered upon God, become disquieted. So that this murmuring discontentedness clearly argues that the soul departs from the living God and looks not upon him as a God able and willing to relieve it in its exigences, a sin doubtless very heinous, and such as much dishonors God's all-sufficiency, and that which God oft punished in Israel, and which was the companion or rather the cause of all their murmurings against him, as appears in Psalms 78:19-20. Can God furnish a table in the wilderness? He smote the rock, but can he give bread also? Can he provide flesh for his people? Secondly, this sin discovers, as a fruit of the former, the going out of the heart after some other portion besides God, nay, more than God, which because it cannot obtain in so large a measure as it desires, like a child that cries because it is pinched in a straitcoat, much too little for it, a man becomes unquiet and complaining. Now how great an impiety is it to lament and complain more for the want of trifles than for the want of that great soul-satisfying good, namely that God who has all in him that may do or make us good. Like a foolish mother who, having many lovely children, will not look upon them, but only regards and delights herself with dolls or puppets made of rags. How deservedly great is that complaint of God! They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and have hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. Inexcusable a wickedness was it for the king of Israel, instead of seeking God, to go to Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, for the recovery of his health. What greater disloyalty than for a soul like Potiphar's wife to wrangle and rage because it cannot obtain its servant, the creature, to satisfy its unclean desires, and to despise the chaste and truly comfortable embracements of its lord, to whom it is married and tied by dearest and strictest bonds. Thirdly, this murmuring discontentedness discovers a great sin of unthankfulness for what portion we enjoy. A murmurer cannot be thankful, nor can he who is thankful for what he has murmur for what he is without. But he wonders that God should give him anything, not frets because God does not give him everything. He says with Jacob, "I am less than the least of all thy mercies," and does not mutter against God for not bestowing upon him greater. This distemper of discontent, contrarily, causes men to think so much of what they want that they quite forget what they already have received. Thus the Israelites discontentedly murmured for what they had not, and unthankfully forget what they had. Discontentedness makes heavy mercies to sink to the bottom and to be forgotten, and light wants and troubles to swim on the top. And it makes men so fretful and that a few are above them that they are utterly unthankful for their being above so many. God loses a friend and a discontented person for but doing with his own as he pleases. Observation 1. God has divided, set out for everyone his portion here in the world. These seducers, in complaining of their part and allotment, show that God appoints to every one his proportion that he thinks fit for them. God is the great householder of the world and master of that great family. And as it was the custom of ancient times to divide and get to every one his portion of meat and drink, and a set allowance of either, whence we read in Psalm 11:6 of the portion of the wicked's cup, so God deals out to everyone what estate he thinks fit. To some he gives a Benjamin's portion in the world, five times so much as to others. He is a sovereign disposer of us and of all our concerns, and he best knows what is best for us. And to his people, he ever gives them that allotment which best suits with their obtaining the true good himself, and ever affords them, if not what they would, yet what they want. Oh, how should this consideration work us to a humble contentedness with all our allotments and make us bring our hearts to our condition? If we cannot bring our condition to our hearts, in a word, when we see that The condition of others is higher than ours. Let us consider that it is better to wear a fit garment than one much too big, though golden. Observation 2. No estate of outward fullness can quiet the heart and still its complaints. These seducers feasted sumptuously, fed themselves to the full, and fared high. And yet for all that, they murmured and complained. The rich man in the gospel, in the midst of all his abundance, cries out, "What shall I do?" Luke 12:17. Neither the life nor the comfort of the life consists in the abundance of the things which we enjoy. None complain so much as they who have the greatest plenty. Though Nabal had in his house a feast of a king, yet soon after his heart died in him, and he became like a stone. 1 Samuel 25:37. Nabal's heart was like the kidney of a beast, which, though enclosed in fat, is itself lean. Solomon in his glory reads a lecture of the creature's vanity. Ahab and Haman were as discontented in heart as great in estate. Vast is the disproportion between the soul and all worldly objects, for they being but momentary and vanishing. Observation 3. They who deserve worst complain and murmur most, and are most ready to think that they are most hardly dealt with. None are so unthankful as the unworthy. Israelites murmur. Absalom is discontented. Haman cries out, "What does all this avail me?" Whereas Jacob tells God that he was not worthy of the least of all the mercies and truth which God had showed him. Genesis 32:10. Job praised and submitted to God when he took from him as well as when he gave to him. None see their unworthiness so little as they who are fullest of unworthiness. And until a man see himself deserving nothing, he will ever complain of God when he abridges him of anything. Besides, the wicked mortify no lusts, and therefore they are angry when their lusts are not fulfilled. But especially they look not upon God as their portion in Christ. And who can be content or praise God that has no spiritual blessings to bless him for? How readily then, instead of being angry with God's dispensations, should we chide our own corruptions and oft blush that so many saints have been so patient under mountains, and that such sinners as we should so complain under feathers? Jude 16, next, walking after their own lusts. Two things are here to be explained. Their guides who led them, their own lusts. They're following these guides. They walked after them. Their guides are set down by way of specification. It is said they were lusts. By their relation or their appropriation to these seducers, and so they are said to be their own. They are specified and denominated lusts. Two things here are considerable. What is meant by lusts, and in what their hurtfulness stands. The word lust is indifferently used concerning lust, good or bad, denoting by its proper force only an earnest desire, and therefore there are lusts not only lawful and indifferent, desiring such objects as tend to the preservation of nature as meat, drink, rest, and so on, Luke 16:21, but also holy and spiritual, in which respect the spirit is said to lust against the flesh, Galatians 5:17. In regard of that new and holy inclination to the regenerate, in which they endeavor to put off the old man and to put on the new, the corrupt lusts, that inordinate disposedness, that inbred and primitive depravity of nature, standing in an aversion from all good and propension to all evil, the root not only of all wicked desires in the will, but of also the evil thoughts in the understanding. It is called lust because it principally discovers itself by sinful lustings, and by them manifests its vigor and strength. And of this speaks the Apostle James in chapter 1:15, when lust has conceived, and so on. Number 2, there is actual lust, every sinful rising or inordinate motion against the law of God, every evil desire springing from the root of original concupiscence. And of these speaks the apostle in Ephesians 2:3. We had our conversation in times past in the lusts of our flesh. And also Ephesians 4:22, that you put off concerning the former conversation the old man, which is corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. Let not sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey it in the lusts thereof, Romans 6:12. Our natural corruption is the root which sends forth these lusts as its branches, and upon them grow those bitter fruits mentioned in Galatians 5:19 and 20. Adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, heresies, and so on. Now these lusts are of two sorts, the vicious inclinations of our minds, or of the upper or rational soul. We must not restrain lust to the sensitive or lower part of the soul only, which they call the unreasonable, exempting the mind and reason from these blemishes. These lusts of the flesh into which the radical pollution of nature has diffused, itself belonging to the understanding and reason also, as well as to the other inferior faculties, the very wisdom of the flesh being, as the apostle speaks, enmity against God, and such as cannot be subject to his law and will, Romans 8:7. For from hence is all impiety, idolatry, superstition, heresy, rejection of the truth, and indeed all those sins which directly are committed against the first table of the moral law, and the apostle expressly mentions the wills of the mind. Ephesians 2:3, in which he understands that superior part called the intellective and discursive. And the apostle, speaking of those who drew others to the superstitious worship of angels, discovers that flesh is found in their very mind or understanding in these words, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind. Colossians 2:18. Number two, the lower and more brutish appetites in the sensitive part of the soul, the motions to uncleanness, drunkenness, gluttony, the lust called of the flesh, 1 John 2:16. The vehement motions of the soul after sensual delights and carnal pleasures, which oft degenerate into beastly excess. These are called the will of the flesh, Ephesians 2:3, joined also with pleasures, serving different lusts and pleasures. The original contagion of man's nature, having poisoned and corrupted all the cogitations of the mind and conceptions of the heart, from them diffuses itself through the affections and inferior appetites, stirs up innumerable inordinate passions to the breach of the second table of the law. And from the corruption of this inferior part, the whole deprivation of nature is, I conceive, called flesh. It drawing the unregenerate from things above and heavenly to such as are below and earthly, from spiritual to corporal objects, from the creator to the creature, and after a sort transforms a man into a beast. And these carnal desires, sensual lusts, are the guides which our apostle says the seducer followed, as is evident from what he had expressed against him in the fourth verse, turning the grace of God into lasciviousness. Verse 8, filthy dreamers defiling the flesh. Verse 10, what they know naturally is brute beasts, in those things they corrupt themselves. Verse 12, feeding themselves without fear, and so on. And from these ungodly lusts, as he calls them, the apostle may well prove them ungodly men. Number two, the sinfulness of these sensual lusts appears in respect of their objects, when such things are desired and craved as are forbidden, whether it be of persons or things. Or number two, of their measure, when things lawful are desired unlawfully because excessively, the desires after food, apparel, sleep, recreations, or any other sensual delights being boundless, and concupiscence unlimited, When in eating men so gluttonize that their souls and their bodies are like a candle and a greasy lantern. When we grasp the world until we make our sinews crack. Oh, how insidious is it for men to grow cold in prayer and hearing, and to sweat in the world, to account a little grace enough, and enough wealth a little. Of their end, number three, when things are desired, not for the glory of God, but for our own pleasure, greatness, and benefit. Not for the advancement of God, but ourselves, when we seek great things for ourselves. Not for fitting us to duty, but for our carnal interest. All the good things we crave should be scaffolds to erect a building of honor to God, not to erect a structure of glory to ourselves. Secondly, these lusts are deceitful. They're not what they seem to be. All the pleasures which are found in them are but false and appearing, not true and real and proper. But secondly and especially, they are termed lusts of deception or error because they do not what they promise. They are deluding and disappointing of that expectation which they raise up in any one. They promise honor, pleasure, riches, and so on, but they perform nothing less and make a man more miserable after all his endeavoring to satisfy them than he was before by their embraces they strangle. They who sow to the flesh of the flesh reap corruption. Lusts end in death and therefore in disappointment. Like a chimney piece, they are fair without, black within. They promise a Rachel, but they give you a Leah. They give not what, but contrary to what they promise. What was Achan's wedge of gold, but an instrument to rive his body and soul asunder? And what did his Babylonish garment clothe him with, but confusion? Hence they who will be rich are said to be falling into foolish lusts, that is, such as make them fools who fall into them, 1 Timothy 6:9. Solomon speaks of a lustful fool who went as an ox to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks. Number three, these lusts are defiling. They are unclean lusts, corrupt and corrupting. The old man is said to be corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, Ephesians 4:22. Christ tells us that the lusts which are within defile a man, Matthew 15:18. They corrupt and defile the very body, as I have shown before, much more the soul, making it an unclean cage of unclean birds. They defile all we are, yea, all we do, prayers, hearings, sacraments. We lift up impure hands, if in wrath. Fourthly, they are disquieting lusts. They are called noisome or hurtful. 1 Timothy 6:9. Every man set upon lust troubles his own flesh. How many more are made martyrs to their lusts than to God himself? Oh, the diseases, losses, torments, disgraces, that uncleanness and drunkenness, ambition, wrath, covetousness, and so on, have brought upon their vassals, who indeed are no other than very hackneys, whipped and driven through thick and thin on obedience to their lusts. But most of all do they fight against the soul, 1 Peter 2:11. By reason of their contrariety, they tear and pull it several ways. They disquiet the conscience. The very worst and foulest days of a saint are better than the days of a sinner's sunshine. How many racks and silent scourges do sinners carry in their bosoms for satisfying their lusts? In a word, they drown the soul in perdition and produce an eternity of pain for a moment of pleasure. To all this, I might add the unquietness of men's lusts to others who live near them. From whence, saith James, come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts? Observation number one. All the visible abominations and notorious extravagancies in the world come from within. Lust is the womb of all the drunkenness, gluttony, adultery, murders. These things come from within, the heart. From the lusts at war in our members come wars and fightings. These seducers fell into all profaneness and licentiousness by following their lusts. A lustful heart makes a lewd life. That is the Trojan horse from whence issue all hurtful practices. We see then the folly of only external mortification. What is the whipping of the flesh? Lying in the ashes, voluntary poverty, outward abstinences, without inward mortification, but the plucking off the leaves, without the withering of the root. The lust must be destroyed inwardly before ever practices can be with success amended outwardly. Christ so cursed the fig tree that it withered at the root. That was a way for fruit never to grow on it anymore. Observation 2. In Reformation, it is not enough to forsake the evils we have no desires after, but we must leave our lust, yea, our own lust, those evils to which we are most inclined. Some men will say that there are no sectaries. Why? Heresy is not their lust. Others say they are not drunkards, when drunkenness is not their lust. The prodigal pleases himself that he is no covetous griper. But this is a token of sincerity, to forsake our own evil ways, and like those who, fighting with an enemy, mar every good piece of ground, to strike at those sins which by custom, constitution, and interest, we are most addicted to. Observation 3. The course of a wicked man in sin is very earnest and impetuous. It is with a sinful lusting and an eager desire. Of this at large before, in Balaam's running greedily. Observation 4. It is the duty of faithful instructors, with Holy Jude here, to tell men of their own lusts, to strike at those sins to which they see them most inclined. Thus did the prophets who lifted up their voice like a trumpet and told Judah of their transgressions. Thus did Christ, who reproved not only idolatry, but Pharisaism and hypocrisy, the sins of his time. Otherwise ministers do but like unfaithful soldiers, who in war discharge not against the enemy, but shoot up into the air, though striking at men's lusts makes ministers hateful, yet it speaks them to be faithful. Observation 5. Miserable is the condition of the poor, misled followers of seducing teachers. The seducer follows his lust, and the follower is led by the seducer. Here it is true, the blind leads the blind. In all solicitations to follow others, we should consider whether they are led by Christ or by their lust. Be followers of others only as they are led by Christ. You set your watches not by the clock, but by the sun. Do so with your hearts. Observation 6. Great may be the comfort to God's people in case of inward, if hateful, temptations. When motions come into the godly, and they do not lust after, but dislike them, nor entertain them with spiritual dalliance, they may be assured that those evils shall not be charged upon them. Before a temptation can be a sin, it must have somewhat of lusting in it. Christ was tempted as we are, and yet he sinned not, because he rejected his temptations. How great a comfort may it be when Christ is your love and lust your dread. Observation 7. Though wicked men have their own several peculiar lusts, yet they all agree together against Christ. Pilate and Herod consent in this. Envy moved the high priest against Christ. Covetousness is what stirred up Judas. Popularity, Pilate. But all these lusts concentrated in opposing Christ. Pharisees and Sadducees unite their forces against him, though they were mortal enemies between themselves. A fever and a lethargy are contrary to one another, yet both are against the health. And therefore, let not people please themselves in opposing some kind of sins. Let them ask themselves whether there be not that within them that is an enmity to Christ. And what a strong argument may this be to the godly, who have their lesser differences, to unite for Christ against sin. Observation 8. Every man's woe and wickedness arises from himself, from his own lusts. The root of all is in ourselves. Every man forges his own confusion and coins his own calamity. None is hurt purely from another. A man, as Augustine says, is an Eve to himself. We must not altogether blame suggestions and temptations without. The devil tempted David to number the people and to look at Bathsheba while bathing. But after both, he confesses that he had sinned. None can hurt him that will not hurt himself. Every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust. Poison would never hurt unless you take it in. The strongest enemy cannot hurt us, nor the falsest delude us, if we will but be true to ourselves. Were there not a complying principle, outward objects of sin would draw out nothing but detestations. As in Christ, in whom, because Satan found nothing, he could do nothing against him. Observation 9. The servitude and slavery of a man that follows his lust is very miserable. Serving divers lusts. Oh, how true a judge is he that is a lackey to his lusts, and who has lust for his leaders and commanders. A servant is hindered from doing anything but what his master pleases. A servant to his lust is in the bond of iniquity, hindered not only from doing, but even from willing to do anything but what pleases his lusts. He is alienated from the life of God. He cannot hear, he cannot pray, he cannot meditate holily. The Romans cut off the thumbs of their slaves, that so they might be able to handle the oar, but not the sword. So the devil hinders his slaves from holy services, but leaves them in a posture of activity for sin. Satan gives some of his slaves longer line than he gives to others, but he ever keeps them in his power.